Beyond Barbarossa, Episode 56, The Lower Dnipro Offensive, for half of Ukraine. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English-language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Murray, podcasting to you today from the Red Beard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin territory, also called Ottawa, Canada. Last episode described the Soviet operations following the Great Battle of Kursk, the largest armored battle in history. We described the major pushes that the Soviet Red Army made against Army Group Center toward the west, as well as operations in the southern part of the Eastern Front, including the recapture of Kharkiv in the Fourth Battle of Kharkiv, and operations toward the city of Belgorod. So that's where the situation was. And at this point, we're talking August 1943. The Stavka, Soviet High Command, which really meant Stalin with some of the people who agreed with him enough, wanted to recapture the city of Smolensk in Western Russia. And as you recall, last episode, the Red Army was getting close to it, but hadn't quite got there. With that proceeding, Stalin's attention went south for Ukraine. All of Ukraine east of the Dnipro River. Now, it was called then the Dnieper, and Dnieper is an anglicization of the Russian name Dnieper, which itself derived from a Ukrainian name, Dnipro. I find it interesting to consider the etymology of that name. According to some sources, it derives from a Sarmatian word, Danu-Apr. Danu is a cognate of the word for the Danube River, the longest river in Europe, which in Sarmatian, Danu-Apr means farther river. Compare that to the word Dniester, another major river in Ukraine, and that translates, if you're looking at Sarmatian, to nearer river. So you have nearer river and farther river. I find it interesting. I'll leave that up to you if you want to delve into that a little bit more. But when it comes to the Dnieper, or Dnipro, here's where it becomes important in the context of the Eastern Front of the Second World War. The Dnipro is the third largest river in Europe after the Volga and the Danube. It's also very deep for most of its length, and doesn't have a lot of natural crossings or fords. In fact, after a certain point, there are none. There are also important rapids or cataracts, such as Oranje Zaporizhia. In its lower reaches, so downstream from Kyiv, naturally it can reach up to 3 kilometers wide. And because of damming at several points, the width is even wider, or it was until Russia destroyed the great dam at the lower parts of the river. But that's a story for another podcast. Another thing about it that makes it a formidable natural barrier for anyone trying to force their way west, as the Red Army would be, was that the western shore is higher and steeper, in some places has bluffs overlooking the river, while the eastern side is pretty low and flat. So that makes it, for the Germans who were retreating, made it a good natural barrier. A defensive line, if you will. Now, what Stalin really wanted in Ukraine was its natural resources. So that meant he would have to clear the Germans out of that eastern bank, which would give them control of the eastern half of Ukraine. And we can see in the operations in 1943, and we can see today in 2024, how important it is to Russia to control Ukraine. Ukraine has resources and industry that the Soviet war machine desperately needed. And it was and continues to be famous as the breadbasket of Europe. That was one reason that Hitler wanted it. But as the Germans retreated in the face of the Soviet advance, they implemented a scorched earth policy, destroying everything of value behind them that they could not carry away. And while the Soviets had done something like that in 1941 as they retreated from the Germans were a lot more efficient about it than the Russians had been. They're Germans, remember? Efficient. Because of this threat of the scorched earth and the loss of that productivity, the Soviet high command decided on a massive broad offensive across most of eastern Ukraine all at the same time. This front stretched close to 1,400 kilometers from Smolensk, and we'll get to that, I promise, down to the Sea of Azov around Taganrog. Taganrog is where the Germans had retreated to following the loss of Stalingrad and then the spring and early summer offensives by the Soviet Red Army, taking Kharkiv and Belgorod and the Meuse River offensives. This would be a good time to point you to maps and photos on the webpage for this episode, and I put a link in the notes for this episode, or you can go to beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com and click on the title for this episode, not on the picture, but on the words. So taking a look at the map I put there, you can see this is a huge front, which means that the Soviets need a huge force to take it. Now, since late 1941, the Soviet military has been growing at a great rate. This growth was fueled by Soviet factories that had been moved east following Operation Barbarossa in June 1941, and they were now increasing their output. It's also by the full mobilization and deployment of people to the German front, but more importantly, by lend-lease aid from the West, particularly the United States. And this included food, clothing, equipment, ammunition, weapons, tanks, even railroads. Now, every time I get to another Soviet operation, so if I'm proceeding as I am chronologically, it seems that the forces that the Soviets are able to deploy get larger, much larger, every single time. I'm just astounded by the numbers of people and weapons that they bring. Millions of people, thousands or tens of thousands of tanks, guns, and airplanes. For the Lower Dnipro offensive operation, the Stavka, that's the Soviet high command, assigned units from five fronts or groups of armies. In total for this operation, 2,633,000 soldiers, 51,200 guns and mortars, 2,400 tanks and assault guns, and 2,850 aircraft. That's immense. And this was deployed against German Army Group South, mostly, and some parts of Army Group Center. But we're focusing on Army Group South at this point. Which at this point in August, September 1943, comprised about 722,000 soldiers, 182,000 from the reconstituted 6th Army, not the same 6th Army that had gone to Stalingrad, plus 200,000 from the 2nd Army of Army Group Center. In total, along this huge front, 1,104,000 people. That's a lot of people, but it's still less than half of what the Red Army brought to the operation. Now, before I get into the actual action on the Eastern Front, it's time for our regular feature. What else is happening in the war in late August 1943? In the Pacific, on 15th August, Canadian and U.S. troops invade Kiska Island in the Aleutians and discover that the Japanese that they were ready to fight had already bugged out. That same day, 15th August, U.S. troops invaded Vella Lavella, one of the Solomon Islands close to Australia. In the Mediterranean, on 6th August, German troops began arriving in Italy in large numbers to take over defense of the peninsula, following the Allied invasion of Sicily in July. On 11th August, German troops began evacuating that island. The Americans took the city of Messina in Sicily on the 16th of August. The next day, the Allies controlled all of the island. On 19th August, Franklin Roosevelt, President of the United States, and Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of Britain, signed the Quebec Agreement during the first Quebec Conference in, you guessed it, Quebec, Canada. Showing German nervousness, the Nazis imposed martial law on occupied Denmark that day. In September 1943, in the Pacific, by 21st September, the long Battle of the Solomon Islands east of Australia is over with an Allied victory. In Europe, Italy, which had arrested former dictator Mussolini at the end of July and is now governed by Marshal Pietro Badoglio, signed a secret armistice with the Allies on 3rd September and formally dropped out of the war. On that day, 3rd September, British troops invaded the Italian mainland at Reggio Calabria in the very south of the country. The next day, the 4th, the USSR declared war on Bulgaria. On the 8th of September, the US formally declared the surrender of Italy, and the Germans began disarming Italian armed forces. On 9th September, the Allies landed at Salerno, Italy. British troops captured Taranto, which is not the same as Toronto. That day, Iran declared war on Germany. On 10th September, German troops occupied Rome as the Italian fleet surrendered to the Allies. 12th September 1943, German SS troops break Benito Mussolini out of a mountaintop prison in Italy. He becomes the head of the Italian Social Republic, a Nazi puppet state. 14th September, German troops occupying Crete murder 500 men in the areas of Vianos and Yerapetra. A week later, 21st September, German troops begin killing Italian soldiers of the Achaea Division on the Greek island of Cephalonia. Over 6 days, they kill over 7,000 Italian. 22nd September 1943, British midget submarines attack and cripple the German battleship Tirpitz, sister to the Bismarck, at anchor in Kalfjord, Norway. And on 25th September, the Red Army recaptures Smolensk, Russia. Sorry for the spoiler. And that's where we'll stop our look ahead for this episode. Because now it's time to turn our attention to the focus of this podcast, the Eastern Front. Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland, and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more on my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
So, as you know, last episode covered Army Group South's retreat from Kharkiv. General Werner Kempf, commander of Army Group Kempf, requested permission to abandon Ukraine's second largest city on 12th August 1943. Erich von Manstein, commander of Army Group South, fired him for this. He put General Otto Wohler in his position and renamed the Army Group the 8th Army. And then, 9 days later, Manstein allowed Wohler to withdraw, which was what Kempf had wanted to do, and the Voronezh Front and the Southwestern Front of the Red Armies moved into the city. Historian Evan Maudsley calls this the Fourth Battle of Kharkiv. It would be the last Battle of Kharkiv until 2022. Evan Maudsley characterized it this way, quote, "the first body blow in the Second Battle of Ukraine," end quote. The next step, the Southwestern Front and the Southern Front of the Red Armies, those are army groups, remember, pushed the 1st Panzer Army and the 6th Army, what was left of it, west. On 3rd September, Hitler refused a request by Field Marshals Gunther von Kluge, commander of Army Group Center, and Erich von Manstein, commander of Army Group South, for the appointment of a commander-in-chief, a single person, to be in charge of the whole Eastern Front. He, Hitler that is, felt that he was the only person capable of performing this job, which seemed a dubious claim soon after as two Red Army fronts reconquered the Donbass, the industrial and mining area of southeastern Ukraine. And they did not stop there. By that time, September 1943, even the Germans had to admit their self-declared military and racial superiority would not stop a Red Army 2 to 3 times its size from sweeping across the open flat steppe. But let's back up just a little. After this reconquest of the Donbass, the action shifted a little bit north, so to the northeastern part of Ukraine. A front stretching from Chernihiv, or in Russian, Chernigov, about 140 kilometers north-northwest of Kyiv, down 370 kilometers to the southeast, and the town of, or the city of, Poltava. The Stavka ordered a broad, simultaneous offensive on this whole front over 300 kilometers, or close to 300 miles long. So for this operation, from north to south, the Red Army deployed the Central Front under Konstantin Rokossovsky. This is 2 tank armies, 6 infantry or combined armies, plus a 16th Air Army. Then the Voronezh Front, commanded by Nikolai Vatutin, 2 tank armies, a tank corps, a cavalry corps, and 7 other armies, plus the 2nd Air Army. And the Steppe Front, 5 armies, the 4th Guards Tank Army, the 5th Air Army, and 8 separate tank and mechanized corps. In September, these forces struck the notorious 4th Panzer Army, which had been so deadly in the Caucasus and in the Battle of Kursk, and the 8th Army, the new 8th Army, which had been reformed out of Army Group Kempf. These German forces put up a ferocious defense, or I guess a better term is a fighting retreat. They also stationed troops in rear guard positions on hilltops, as the steppe has some hills, and in towns and villages along the way. These exacted huge casualties on the advancing Red Armies. But despite their claims of superiority, even these formidable German armies could not withstand the overwhelming numbers of Red Armies bearing down on them. By September, even the Germans had to admit they could not stop the Red Army advancing across the flat, open steppe. This brings us to the Ostwall. After the failure of Kursk in early August, Hitler had ordered the construction of an eastern wall, the Ostwall in German. This is a series of defensive positions all along the eastern front, from the Baltic to the Black Seas. The section from Lake Peipus in Estonia to the Baltic Sea was called the Panther Line for some reason. The rest of it, from Smolensk, or just west of Smolensk, all the way down to the along the Dnieper, or Dnipro, and then kind of from that easternmost bend of the Dnipro down to the Sea of Azov in a straight line. That was called the Wotan Line, for Wotan, the Teutonic god. Now, the Germans did not have the time nor the resources to build a defensive line that was, you know, like the Maginot Line the French had built along their border with Germany. So what this was basically ditches, trenches, machine gun nests, anti-tank gun emplacements, and so on. There were also minefields and more. And getting past this for an assaulting force would not be easy. And behind it was, for most of the length of it, the Dnipro River. But it wasn't a single long, solid defensive line. There were lots of gaps or areas where, at most, there were overlapping zones of fire control. On the 8th of September, Hitler flew from his Wolf's lair in East Prussia, his military headquarters for the Eastern Front, to Army Group South's headquarters, von Manstein's headquarters, in Zaporizhia, Ukraine, and he met with von Manstein. Von Manstein was one of the few German generals or field marshals who was willing to tell Hitler the truth about the situation on the Eastern Front. Von Manstein said he would need 12 more divisions to hold the Donbass. The thing was, the Germans didn't have another 12 divisions to throw into this, not when they were fighting in Smolensk farther to the north, nor trying to hold Italy against the Western Allies all at the same time. So Hitler authorized a withdrawal of German forces. He had to face the music. He ordered a withdrawal of German forces to the Ostwall, or the Wotan Line, and that's what led to a race to the Dnipro River. The Germans had to escape being overrun by the Red Army, and the Soviets wanted to recapture Ukraine to prevent the Germans from burning everything in their wake. We'll get to that next episode. In southern Russia, the Germans held on to a toehold on the Taman Peninsula, that finger of land extending westward to the Kerch Peninsula in Crimea. It was the last bit of the North Caucasus area, or the Kuban steppe, that the Germans held after Stalingrad and the Red Army's spring offensives. The remnants of the 17th Army, part of Army Group B, which had penetrated into the North Caucasus in 1942, retreated into the Kuban bridgehead, which they called Gotenkopfstellung, or Goth's Head, by February 1943. They held on to this little bit of land despite successive Red Army attacks, supplied partly by a cable car system over the Kerch Strait. But as the rest of the Eastern Front withdrew to the Ostwall, the 17th Army was ordered to retreat from the Taman Peninsula into Crimea. Stalin sent a note to Colonel General Petrov, commander of the Northern Caucasus Front, and Vice Admiral Vladimirsky, commander of the Black Sea Fleet, saying this, quote, "Today, 16 September, our troops of the Northern Caucasus Front, in collaboration with the ships and units of the Black Sea Fleet, as the result of a daring operation by an attack on land and the landing of a force from the sea, after 5 days of fierce battles, in the course of which the German 73rd Infantry Division, the German 4th and 101st Mountain Infantry Divisions, the Romanian 4th Mountain Infantry Division, and the Harbor Defense Force of the German Marines were routed, took by storm the important Black Sea port and town of Novorossiysk, just east of the Crimean Kerch Straits." End quote. And that was from Anthony Tucker Jones' excellent book, Slaughter on the Eastern Front. So with southern Russia and eastern Ukraine taken care of, the focus of the Red Army returned to Ukraine as they pushed from the front of the along the Mias River and the Donets across to try to capture the eastern bank of the Dnipro River. As they pushed westward, they encountered the city of Poltava. Fighting there was especially difficult. The Germans held on grimly, so Ivan Konev, marshal of the steppe front, decided to skirt around the city instead and head straight for the main goal, the Dnipro River. The Red Army finally took the city of Poltava on 23rd September 1943. By that time, the Red Army, or other elements of the Red Army, had reached the Dnipro, which meant they had retaken half of Ukraine, including the very valuable Donbass. On the night of 21st to 22nd September, units of the 3rd Tank Army, part of the Southwestern Front, crossed the Great River, using anything they could, boats, rafts. They even improvised rafts made of logs and anything else that floated, and some of them swam. That same night, the 21st to 22nd September, Marshal Vatutin of the Voronezh Front sent forces across the river into a boggy area north of Kyiv, where the Germans did not expect a crossing because, yeah, it was boggy, not really suitable for armor. This unexpected landing allowed the Soviets to establish and then expand a bridgehead on the western side of the Dnipro. On the night of 24th to 25th September, the Voronezh Front tried to drop parachute troops over the river at Veliky Burin, which is somewhat south of Kyiv. But because of delays and poor reconnaissance, they were easily spotted. The Germans wiped them out. Still, the important thing to remember here is the Red Army had reached the river in the middle of Ukraine, and in some places were starting to cross it. Then, shift north, the Kalinin Front broke into Smolensk, driving Army Group Center back. And that's where we're going to have to leave off this episode. Next time, we're going to be looking at the Second Battle of Smolensk and the crossing of the Dnipro River. That all happened at the end of September 1943, which is fitting because that's when I'll be back in this chair in the Redbeard studio. I'm going to take a late summer vacation, so I'll be off for the next couple of weeks, and I'll be back with you on 30th September 2024. Talk to you then. So until then, thank you for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. I want to thank all of you who have supported the podcast through Patreon and other means. It really makes a big difference. If you like the episode, please consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app. And maybe take a minute to give it a rating on Apple Podcasts, Google, Amazon, Podbean, wherever you listen. Doing that helps raise the profile and notifies other people who are interested in history that this podcast exists. If you find I've made any errors, if you have a correction or a comment or a question, please reach out through email contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. And I, Scott Burry, I'm all over all the socials. Well, not all of them, a lot of them. So you can find me really easily. Have something to say? Please share it. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. And you know I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina.